Hi, it's Michael, and before we start the episode, I just want to do a little bit of a call to action. I've put a Just Giving link in the show notes. It is for a chap called Ben, who is one of the trainers down at Manor Gyms. He suffered an injury that will potentially change his life, and they're raising funds to support him through his rehab and recovery. There is a free session every Friday afternoon on behalf of Ben, where you could just turn up for free if you wish, or you can contribute to the Just Giving page, which I've put in the show notes. Thank you so much. That is Manor Gyms in London, Victoria. My name is Michael Coates. I'm a former firefighter, but I'm also a former soldier. And it's the stories from the individuals within this military community that I'm desperate to document. In this episode, we speak with a former Royal Marine who has a talent for magic and a story of war. We talk about his time in Iraq, seeking more in his life, and his time in Afghanistan. We also speak about grief, violence, reflection, and adventure. Episode 53, James Stott. This is Declassified.
Born in York.
Yeah, 1984, Viking capital of England.
Who, so parents, brothers, sisters?
Yeah, I've got two brothers, one older and one younger. I'm in the middle. And yeah, we parents, we're both together, you know. It's a nice sort of, I was born into, you know, just a beautiful, loving family. It was perfect.
And was it always in York, was it?
We stayed in York until I was eight. And then we moved up to Northumbria. And I sort of was in Northumbria for a brief period of time before moving to the East Coast, just outside Scarborough. And that's where I kind of grew up through my teens in Scarborough.
I sometimes ask people this because I always find it fascinating. Do you have like a first childhood memory?
Yeah, I can remember being at nursery. I can remember being at nursery because we used to have story time, and I fell asleep on the mat and my mum would be like waking me up like, James. And you know, it'd be empty. And I'm like, oh shit.
Yeah. And childhood then itself, was it, you said it was loving, was it sporty? Was you doing stuff together, or was you know, dad out working and mum looking after
the
family?
My dad worked a lot, yeah. So he was, initially he was working at Barclays. He was a businessman, and he was, I remember him, he was away a lot, but every time he came back, you know, he was very loving and gave us a lot of time. We were very outdoorsy. My mum really kind of squared us away with a good diet, really looked after us, good food. Very, very wholesome living.
Well, because I remember, like, you know, we're a year apart, I'm a year older, and there was quite, in my household, there was quite a lot of, like, processed food, but still, like, fruit and veg and stuff. But was your mum, was she caring? Was she, like, really loving? And did you, and you, like you said, like, did she understand that you had to put good stuff into you?
Yeah, yeah, she was amazing. I still am so grateful to her for the foundation that she gave me to build upon. You know, me and my brothers, we're all, you know, good, healthy lads. And it's because the way my mum brought us up.
What was the holidays like? You know, did you go away?
Yeah, we did. We did a lot of camping holidays up in Scotland. So my parents loved the west coast of Scotland, the Outer Hebrides, Mull. We'd have family holidays would be family time, camping, drive up there. Occasionally go abroad, but no, normally family holidays were sort of camping in Scotland.
Adventurous
family
stuff.
Time. Yeah, yeah, out cycling, walking, a lot of walking. My mum loves bird watching, so she would love, really? Like, you know, yeah, going up there to look at that. And yeah, very, yeah, lots of, I guess, activities, you know, just trying to give us a good upbringing.
Mate, the older I get, the more I love watching nature and birds, yeah. You know, like how they move and how other birds behave around certain birds. And I think there's a lot of like therapeutic kind of activity in that, you know, just looking. Did you spend, you know, you're in Scarborough, you're going up to, you know, do these kind of adventurous holidays. Did you spend a lot of time in nature?
Yeah, yeah. So where we lived, we're out, you know, I don't know how far it was, maybe 10 miles out of Scarborough. But we're in the fields, the woods, and as I got a little bit older, I was always outdoors, and I had a little air rifle and I had a little motorbike, and you know, as I got a bit older, I'd sort of fill up my motorbike and just go off adventuring through the woods just for a day, just right, like exploring.
How old was you when you had a motorbike?
I mean, I would have been, I think I was probably like 14 when I had the motorbike. But before that, I used to, you know, I'd go running up into the woods with my bro. We live near a river, so I was always in nature, always around water.
Was you swimming from an early age?
Yeah, I really got into swimming. Like, I loved swimming. I used to swim at a club. I feel very comfortable in the water. Although recently I've had a few scares because I've pushed it too far, you know, when the water's too cold. Mm. And it's, I'm just very, very cautious now of, you know, when you see an island, you're like, oh, I'm going to swim to that island. It's like, maybe put a wetsuit on.
Let's risk assess.
Take a float. Yeah,
let's
risk
assess that, yeah.
Yeah.
I remember, because I'm kind of seeing parallels because I used to be always in the North Sea, Hornsea, Bridlington, Scarborough, always as a little kid, you know, in February, well, maybe not February, but March, April, May, I'd be in the water.
Yeah.
And it's such a good kind of environment to judge risk and understand and appreciate risk. You've already said like the motorbikes, being around water. Was there a lot of risk taking?
Yeah, 100%. I remember one time when we lived in Northumbria, so I was probably 8 or 9, and I remember I jumped into like real deep water and I had a set of wellies on, and the wellies just filled up with water and took me to the bottom, and I just sank. And I was like, I remember kicking them off and swimming up to the top. But you know, there was a few years on from there, we had a holiday to Spain, and I remember I looked out into the water and I seen my little bro struggling. It was like almost like a double break, and he was struggling. And I think I was 15 by this time, and I swam out and got him and brought him in. But there's been a few times where it's like, yeah, on that edge.
You said that your dad used to work for Barclays. What did your mum do?
She was a nurse and a midwife. So she switched. I think she was a nurse, and then she went into midwifery. And then when she was having us lot, she kind of eased off, went back into nursing, and went back into midwifery again. Yeah. Mm. She sort of flipped between the two, and then when she retired from working in the hospital, she went out to Ghana to teach neonatal care out there, because they have a lot of, you know, little babies dying and, you know, poor hand hygiene. So she went out to teach out there and stuff, like the skills that she learned. She's an awesome midwife.
Tell me about you, because you joined the Territorial Army.
Yeah.
You joined that in 2002.
Yeah.
Was she keen for you to join that?
I think she knew that I was going to go. By this point, she knew that I was going to go into the military. I think it was inevitable. I look back at photos of me, probably same as you, like as a young lad, wearing a pair of combat trousers. Like I said, I had my air rifle, enjoyed running around, shooting. You know, it was inevitable that I was going to go down that path. So I don't think, she never really said anything. I don't know if I even told her. I might have just said, I've joined.
Was you sporty as a kid as well, though? Was there an obvious like physical path?
Yeah, I loved sort of more adventure stuff like assault courses, or as opposed to like, I never really, you know, never really got into football, but I enjoyed climbing, running, and sort of more adventurous stuff.
So joining the TA, what was the process of that?
So it's a bit of a weird one, really. So like I was living in Scarborough till about 16, then my parents moved again. They moved to the Yorkshire Dales. I stayed in Scarborough, and then 17, just coming on 18, I moved up to Scotland. The initial plan had been like for further education, and when I was up there, I was renting a bedroom in a house. I think I was initially in a shared bedroom in this house in Scotland. It was a bit of a random time. I'm not really sure why I drifted off like that. And I'd been in cadets when I was young. So I'd been in, when I was in Scarborough, I was in the Green Howard cadets. And then I remember a guy telling me about the territorials, saying, oh, it's kind of like cadets, but you're getting paid for it when you're old enough, sort of thing. I was like, it makes sense. So I was on a further education course up in Scotland, in Inverness. And I ended up joining I went to look at the Royal Marine Reserves, but their unit wasn't up and running for some reason. And I ended up just joining the Highlanders up there. It's a bit of a sort of random move, really.
And then was that full time? I mean, it sounds strange. That was that weekends only, or was it full time.
So that was weekends only. And then I did that that was in 2002. And then I went into a full-time reserve service. And then I got attached to the Welsh Guards they were based in Cardiff at the time.
Do you remember March 2003, February 2003? Do you remember seeing the Iraq kind of in brackets invasion? Because you'd have been in then.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I said, I can't really remember it.
No.
I guess I would have known it was going on, yeah.
So was there ever a point then when, because you deployed in
2004.
Yeah. When did you realise that might be a prospect?
In 2003 I knew about it because there were lads who had gone out on the first helic who had come back, and I was like, oh, they've earned a bit of cash, got some money saved up. You know, I didn't really understand. I was so naive. So naive.
And then did you volunteer to go then? 2004.
Yeah,
so that was Telic 5 and things were starting to really heat up, you know, the 2000, Telic 3 into 4 and now into 5. Did you volunteer?
Yeah, I will have done. Send me out there. Let's go see what that's about. Yeah, completely didn't understand what it was. And I went out, deployed out to Basra with the Welsh Guards as a mini-me gunner, worked on the Snatch Land Rovers a lot as a rear gunner or foot patrols. And I just remember so I was probably 19 at the time. I remember standing, we're based in this little place called Old State Buildings in Basra City Centre. So between the Shah Al Arab Hotel and Basra Palace. And I just remember just standing there thinking, what am I doing here? What am I doing? And we get IDF'd, so indirect fire, Chinese rockets coming in, and you just hear them whistling. It's like, oh, where's that going to land?
So you're on the river?
No, we're in the city centre.
Oh, you're right in the centre? Yeah,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah. The other two bases were on the river, yeah.
Yeah.
And we'd road move up to the others to get resupplies and that sort of stuff.
And what was going on then? So you were like 19?
Yeah.
Explain what was going on. I'll tell you what, I'll rephrase it. Firstly, did you feel like a professional?
Nah, obviously the training, it was sort of like backdoor entry into the military. And I didn't feel like I was fully trained for what we're doing. I didn't understand things. I didn't understand like reference points or the clock ray method. I didn't understand how to like ID a target I was pretty naive. I definitely wasn't trained.
Underprepared?
Yeah, underprepared, yeah.
Go on.
Yeah, but I did feel I was keen and I was physically fit, and I did, I'd always, when I was at school, a lad had said to me, why don't you join the Marines with me? And I said, I can't join the Marines. They're like supermen. And I dismissed it. I had so much self-doubt. I just didn't even contemplate the idea. But that was then in my head, the Marines. And I remember seeing them up at Basra Palace and, you know, with the flashes on the sleeve, Royal Marines Commando. I was like, shit, there, you know, I want to do that. And I remember looking around the lads I was working with and I was thinking, mate, you know, I want to give it a shot. Yeah.
So the lads you were with, were they TA or were they?
No, they were regular. Yeah, regular army, Welsh Guards.
It's not arrogant to say this, Nick, and I'm not going to put words in your mouth, but did you feel
I thought I could do better than that? Yeah, I thought I could do better than this, yeah.
And that tour, what did it teach you regards? Was it traumatic? Was it chaotic? Was the stuff going on?
I didn't enjoy it. Yeah, it was. I just remember being just so naive to, like, I was just walking around Basra, like, what's going on? Car bomb go off, you know, suicide bombers, you know, IDFs, RPGs, RPG, the convoy. I was in a dream.
Yeah, yeah.
I was like, oh, what's this place? Man, it's bad. It's so bad to think about it.
Yeah.
No, I didn't enjoy it. And I don't really know what I learned from it other than I was like, I don't ever want to come back here. Yeah,
I was there the year before in Basra Palace, and it is like a dream.
Yeah,
it feels to me like a dream. Even when I was going, driving through past where you're saying, it's just so full on.
At this point, I'd never traveled before. I'd had maybe a family holiday to Spain like 5 years previous or something like this, but I'd never traveled. I didn't, and all of a sudden I'm in this place. There's palm trees and canals and We're next to the slaughterhouse, which stunk. The river would be like browny red from the slaughterhouse and whatever else was going on in there. You know, yeah, it's pretty honking place.
When you came back then, was there like a period of decompression?
Nah. I was on a we flew back, and then we were on a big coach heading back up to Scotland. And obviously, we're going past Scotch Corner. My parents were in the Dales at this point, and I was like, can I get off here? And I just got off and went home. I hitchhiked from Scotland. We're on about to Richmond.
What was you dressed in?
I was in rig. Just come back from Iraq. And I remember, because I'd had my R&R previous, but I can't remember when that was. And I remember I just walked up to the house and I rang the doorbell. And my little bro's like, are you back? And he's like, you're not going away again? I was like, no, I'm back now. And yeah, it was funny. Yeah. It was nice. I just sort of rocked up. I hadn't told them I was coming home.
And well, you know, when you come back from something like that, especially, you know, 1920, was you going back? Did you have friends in the area, or what did you do next?
I didn't really know, because I hadn't gone to school in Richmond and I hadn't worked there. I didn't really know many people there. So I'd come back. It was into the summer. One of my best mates had just finished uni. I had some money saved up from the tour, and we just started chatting about traveling. Well, should we go traveling? And that seemed like the good thing to do. At the time, I was like, yeah, I'm done with the military. Like, you know, I don't want to do that. And we ended up doing a sort of a, we planned our own round the world trip, which was really awesome.
Where'd you go?
Flew into New York. And initially, so we got into New York, and it was, because we're young lads, and I think a lot of anger and stuff, and coming back from Iraq, I'd get pissed off very easy. You know, if people walked through a door and let the door drop in my face, and I was like, I've just come back from Basra. You know, I had a lot of, get angry. We went to New York, and it's like, oh, Central Park's dangerous. So we went and pitched up and camped in Central Park. And then we climbed up the New York Public Library. It's got these mega balconies. And one time we climbed up into one of these balconies and slept up there. we traveled up. We went up to Detroit as a big Eminem fan. And we ended up buying a car for $300 on the 8 Mile Road. You know, went around his trailer park. And then we drove this car 6,000 miles across America, bought a road atlas, and we just lived out this car. We had no number plates. We'd get stopped by the police. and we sold it in LA for $300. And then we flew to New Zealand, bought another car there, went around camping. It was in New Zealand that I started saying, I'm going to join the Marines. When I get back, I'm going to join the Marines. And I started training for it. And like I said before, you know, I kind of say what I'm going to do because that holds me accountable. I tell everyone, you know, because then people are like, oh, I thought you're training for the Marines. You know, if I'm sitting there eating a pizza. So like my mate, he used to like sleep in a lot. He would have big lie-ins. So I'd get up in the morning and I'd just set off running. And at some point, an hour, 2 hours later, he would pick me up in the car. I'd just set off running down the road. It was cool. And then we did Australia, went to Thailand. We're both big into our Muay Thai, so we went to just stayed at a camp and trained. And then we finished our trip in Rome and we made our own way back to England. We were going to do it long way round style, buy some motorbikes and ride. But I had a friend from Iraq come and join us. So then there were three of us and he couldn't ride. So we ended up doing on the trains.
From just, Rome?
Yeah, from Rome back to England. Ah. Yeah.
And because that long way round, that was you and McGregor and...
Yeah, Charlie Borman.
That's the one, yeah. And I remember being really inspired by that.
Yeah.
And we're, I suppose that was the age of, not quite internet yet, but it was, things seemed a bit more freer and you could get on and do stuff. And there was the people like that showing you actually there's permission, go and travel, do bits and pieces. Was that adventure always still on your mind? Was it?
Yeah. I've liked adventure. And I'm also my friend. So this is the guy that got me into motorbiking. He's the one who taught me how to ride. So he was very much into that. Yeah, he loves it.
Mm. And when you got back, then what was the plan?
So as soon as I got back, I applied for the Marines because I'd been thinking about it, started to train. And I was like, yeah, I'm doing this. Got back in 2006 and put my application in and joined the Marines and passed out of training in 2007 and went up to 4-5 commando.
Do you think your stint in the reserves, do you think that had a big impact on you joining and wanting something more?
Do you know what? A lesson learned from that is just go for the thing to start off with. I should have just gone for the Marines. And if I'd failed that, I could have joined the Highlanders or the Welsh Guards or whatever. Like, don't sell yourself short and dismiss doing something because you think you're not good enough. I should have just gone for the Marines when I was 18. I think obviously it developed me. I think I've only just matured now. I don't know if it's taken me a long time.
Were you 22 when you joined?
When I joined the Marines, yeah. Yeah, 21, 22.
Is that because when I joined, I was 16 and it seemed like there's a lot of lads between 16 and 18 joining the army, joining the engineers. You know what I mean? Like, to be a 20-year-old would have had 4 years experience. Yeah. In the Marines, was there a lot of older lads or was it young lads or a mix?
I think I sort of had a stint with army infantry and I think you do get a younger lad joining that. I think the Marines tends to be a little bit older, so more kind of early 20s. And it went all the way up. The oldest lad in our troop was 32.
Did it feel more like you were meant to be there?
Yeah. Yeah, 100%. And it was proper training and it just, you know, built me up. I hadn't gone through something like that. I think that's the only time in my life when I've really felt I've got purpose and know what I'm doing. Because before, you know, when I was training for the Marines, in my bedroom, I had a poster up of the Marines. I'd go out running and all this. And it was like, I'm going to join the Marines. And if I fail, I'm going to join the Marines. I'm going to get fitter and join it. There was nothing. There was no second option. It was Marines. And I remember at the time, the recruitment advert said 99.99% need not apply. And I remember saying this to this girl's mum. And she said to me, oh, what are you going to do when you don't get in? And I was baffled by it. I was like, no, I'm the 0.01%. Like, there isn't an option of me not getting in. So when I went into, I remember mum saying to me, just that I looked really well. You know, I was very physical. I knew what I wanted to do and it was to get that green lid.
And was that a proud moment getting it?
Oh, 100%. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's mecca.
How does it happen?
How do you get it?
Yeah. Like so, the last bit, you know, like the ceremony or whatever. When do you get presented it?
You first get it. Well, you get it to shape it to then get presented after your 30 miler. So the Marines is known as the longest, hardest, most arduous infantry training in the world. It's 32 weeks, which is kind of like 9 months. You get to week 26 and then you go into the commando phase. And then it sort of culminates in the commando tests and the last one being the 30 mile speed march, sort of run across Dartmoor in a certain time in fighting order. And as you come across, after the 30 miles, you're coming in, you come over this little bridge and that's where you finish and you get presented the green beret. And I knew all the way through that 30 mile, because we'd been given our berets to shape so that they didn't look like a bag of shit on our head. And we'd put our names in them. And I was like, there's a green lid there with my name in it and I'm going to go get it.
Mm.
I'm not stopping. Yeah, so I was...
2008, you deployed to Afghan.
Yeah.
That was Telic 5. What was the feeling?
On Herrick 9, yeah.
Oh, Herrick 9, bigger plan.
Yeah, yeah.
Was the feeling different?
I think, yeah, because, so this, what's happened here now is I've joined the Marines and it's been gradual build up of the same thing, of a repetition of going to battle to fight through an enemy position and to keep fighting. And it's, you go through training and initially you're going through the moves, you're going through formations, you fight through a position. Then you're doing it with blank rounds, then you're doing it with live rounds. Then you're doing your PDT, which is your pre-deployment training. This is now Afghan specific. Okay, we're going to take this compound. And it's building up and up and up. Live firing again, you're shooting, you're training, you're honing all these skills. Then you've had these specific skills. Then you get out there and you're in Bastion and they go, okay, this is the threats that we're dealing with. Then you're deployed out to your forward operating base or your OP. And it's been this gradual build-up all the way. You haven't just gone, what happened with Iraq is I'd literally gone from being a naive little lad to being in Basra City Centre with a mini-me. And then with the Marines, I'd joined the Marines with the intention of, I am going to be a Royal Marines Commando. I've gone through this gradual progression. So by the time I'm now out in Afghan, fight through enemy position. Mm. It wasn't a shock. This is what we've been building up to.
Was that what you were doing? Were you fighting?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's very kinetic. I was at a place called FOB Gibraltar. And it was, Yeah, a lot of fighting. Yeah.
What would a day in the life be like?
So we rolled it on, it was a 5-day rotation. So 5 days patrolling on the ground and then 5 days doing guard on the camp. So the camp was a small fortified compound with little gun turrets on the corners, basically. North wall was like where the main enemy threat was, and we had like grenade machine gun, the heavy machine gun, and the GPMG up there, and then GPMGs on other corners. And it was, yeah, so there was never like a day, we never had a down day. It was 5 days on guard like that, rotating through those positions, and then 5 days out on the ground, dominating, taking ground. Like pretty much, because you're in a fixed location, there's only X amount of directions you can go from the FOB.
Mm.
So they started IED belting us. So they know that we're only going to go that way or that way. So they just put IEDs everywhere. And then we, you know, it's just always, you're just always advancing. So then maybe we'd go out in the night, you know, with a cover of darkness and sit up in a stream somewhere in a wadi and wait until day. And then we'd hit them or come in from somewhere. They'd be like, whoa, how did they get there? You know, just throw them off a little bit.
And when you say IDs and ID belts, is that, so you're saying, and what was the impact of that? As in the psychological and the physical impact of having IDs?
I went out as an advance party, and it was, we took over from two para. So I went out patrolling with the lads there, and I was very much aware that there's bombs in the ground. So I was like watching the bloke's footsteps in front of me. So I'm like making sure I stood exactly where he stood. I'm checking my arcs. It's red hot. I've, you know, guns in the shoulder. I'm like, I'm good to go. And it's not sustainable. It's fatiguing. I was exhausted. And it's like, you just got to take it on the chin and just kind of swallow it and go, if it happens, it happens. Because you can't operate at that level of anxiety, that tension, you know, like watching everything, you know, it's look at the, you know, if it happens, it happens.
Yeah. Are you in, even when you're in the FOB or on guard, or are you in a kind of a heightened level all the time? I think you kind of answered it. Does that environment allow you to settle?
Nah. We had no downtime. No, it was hard. I think it was hard work. It was hard. I found it hard graft.
And were lads getting injured?
Yeah, like first, literally like the second week into the tour, we went out and, oh man, it was a bit nuts. I was kind of like the sergeant's runner. I had a 51mm mortar that I carried in my day sack with some bombs. And I'd done like another medic course, like an FA1, FA2. I'd done this, you know, so I was kind of like troop medic, sergeant's runner kind of guy. We'd gone out on patrol, we'd sort of gone firm on a compound. And then as we set off from this compound, the stripey, the sergeant was like, actually, you know, switch me around with this other lad. We walked around this corner, this other lad stood on a, you know, like maybe an ape. Any personnel, mine, blew his leg off. And it's just one of those, like, literally as we'd set off, the sergeant had pulled me back, you know, so it's one of them like, oh. So he got blown up in front of me and then helped treat him on the ground. That was like in the second week, I think. So like we were getting hit, we were taking casualties right from the start, really.
Who replaces those lads when they get
medevaced out? Yeah, you get young lads straight out of training who are coming as BCRs. Battlefield casualty replacements who were filling those gaps, because we were sort of undermanned, really. That's why we didn't have any time to have a day off, because there wasn't many of us in that. The main aim for us in that location was to intercept enemy fighters who were trying to go up to Sangin. So it was just to kind of give Sangin a bit of relief. So we were engaging there, trying to scrap them before they went up to Sangin.
Was it important then? You know, you said on Telic in Iraq, you didn't know and you didn't understand. Was it important then on Herrick that you did understand that what your job was?
Yeah, you need to sort of know what you're doing and why you're doing it. But still, it's like, it's such a blinkered view of what's going on. You know, like, so my job is to engage enemy fighters here. That's it. But I still didn't understand the big picture. I still don't understand it now. I'm very naive to the whole conflict. I started disagreeing with things. You know, it felt a bit jack.
In what way?
If you're born in Afghan, like, if I was in Afghan, I'd be the Taliban. Yeah. Like you would be. It's, I don't know, it sounded weird. It's just strange, isn't it?
Well, it's empathy, isn't it?
Yeah.
I had a similar conversation with a mate of mine a few years ago who's Irish. And I said, if the working class lad from Leeds joins the British Army, the working class lad from Belfast, who's Catholic, joins the IRA.
Mm.
And he was like, no. I said, yeah, it's exactly what happens.
People are just
same,
people.
They're the same lad.
Yeah.
They're just born in a different place.
That's it, yeah. And I felt it was a bit jack, especially for the farmers and that sort of stuff, for the locals. They're just caught up in this mess. You know, they don't want to. It's not as simple as goodies and baddies, which is what I thought it was.
Mm.
But it's not that simple. Nothing in life's that simple.
Especially in conflict like that. Can you tell us a bit about New Year's Eve?
Yeah, so New Year's Eve was that. We went out on a patrol. It was just like a nice sunny day like it is today. There's just like a big explosion. And we're walking in, we're patrolling like a linear formation because the guy in the front's got the, like a metal detector checking the ground for the bombs. So everyone takes a knee and then it just starts raining down mud and debris, you know. And then I heard like shouting, like screaming. And for some reason, I think because I was kind of like troop medic, or for some reason, I was like, yeah, I've got this. And I got up and I just ran towards it. And I remember I was running down the line of lads and they're all on a knee. They're just watching me go past. And I came to a wadi, a streamline with some trees. And I jumped. This is where the blast had been. Wow. I remember looking down and I was like, who's fucking Bergen's on the floor? It looked like a Bergen with a helmet on it. And I was like, there's one of the lads. Jumped over this stream to the other guy who was maybe 10 metres out into this open field. And he had been fragged up, just had bits of his arms missing. And so I put a tourniquet on and he's looking at me. And he's like, am I going to be all right, sort of thing? I'm like, yeah, man, it's cool. He's like, well, why have you put a tourniquet on? And I was like, you know, so I started bandaging his arm up and came under quite intense enemy fire then. And I just put my back to the enemy to kind of protect us with, in my head, I was protecting us with the back plate that I was wearing, which is probably the size of an A4 piece of paper.
Mm.
But in my head, I was like, I'll shield us with that. And I had to get this bandage wrapped up because I knew that if I started dragging him out of that area, it would snag and he'd come undone. So I got that fastened up, got a grip of him, and I ran backwards dragging him. I jumped down into the stream and I held his head out of water and I gave him morphine, banged the morphine in his leg. And then I got a few lads to pass him up to me. I climbed out the other side and we were carrying him. There was me, there was a mini-me gunner, and then there was a Navy medic and an interpreter who were both quite small lads. And we were then casivacking him, carrying him out of battle through this ploughed field, man, out in the open. And it was hard. It was like so hard. And I could see a compound and the lads were going, I can't do it. You know, like it's you know, I'm hanging out. We need to put him down. And I was like, no, we need to let's just get to that compound and we can put him down, have a rest. And they ended up kind of just putting him down on the deck. And I was like, fucking hell. I ripped his front plate out because he was kind of a bit fragged up, you know, a bit shredded and that. Pulled his front plate out and I got him onto my shoulders. And man, I could hardly stand up. My legs were blowing. And I got up and I just carried him on my shoulders out because I just had to get him out of that open ground. Got round the edge of this compound wall and I seen two Afghan National Army lads just watching me. I was like, well, get over here, you know, give me a hand with this. And we weren't that far out of the base. So the sergeant major's come out on his quad with the trailer to pick up the casualties and I dropped him off. Yeah. And then I ran back to get the other lad, who had been killed. And we're carrying him out on a poncho.
Mm.
And I remember I was just looking at his face, you know, like he still had his helmet on, but the chin strap was through his mouth, you know, and he was just white. Like he was blitzed, but his face was all right and that. And it was hard work, you know, carrying him, got him onto the stretcher, got him onto the quad. And then there was this bit when I was running back into battle, and I must have had just like an adrenaline dump. I felt absolutely drained, and it was a nice sunny day, and it felt like I was just running by myself. There was no one else around me. It's really weird, really surreal, and I was just running to go back into the scrap, basically.
And was there fighting to be done after that?
Yeah,
did you carry on fighting?
We were pulling back though. We pulled back because we weren't that far from out of the fob, and we had to get that lad Kazivak'd out. Had to call in a helo. Yeah, it's a bit of a nuts situation.
And you know, you said there was a bit of a mix of people there. Do you know the lads? Are you friends with the lads? The lad that died, the lad that got injured. Are you friends, or is it disjointed?
So the lad who I patched up on the ground, he's Mega Sound, and he wrote me a letter a few years later, as a character reference, which I needed. But also, there's been times when he's dropped me a text saying, you know, thanks for everything you did that day. And we're going into the bit when I went on R&R.
Well, we talked about this just briefly before. Let's talk about that. Let's go to R&R.
Yeah, so I went for my R&R. The tour was coming to an end. I went for an R&R end of February, so then we only had March to push. So it was like a month before the end of tour, and I went back.
Had you done 5 or 6 months then?
Yeah.
Straight?
Yeah.
And then you'd gone back for a couple of weeks?
For 2 weeks, yeah.
Sorry, go on.
Yeah, and then we went, I'd gone out for a meal, and I was walking back to the car, gone out for a meal in York. Again, it's really weird because you've gone from a war zone, like from having scrapping sort of every day. I remember when we came back, because we'd flown out the compound. Oh man, it's nuts, because before that we'd had another 2 KIA, and I remember taking one of the, like, literally we're taking the weapons, their weapons.
The two lads that died.
Yeah, two lads that died, and we had like clinical waste bags and stuff, taking it back to Bastion. And I remember I saw my corporal from training, who was an armourer, and I was giving him this weapon, which was still, you know, still had a bullet in the chamber, essentially, still made ready with a round. And I was giving it to him, and I remember like looking at him saying, you never said it was going to be like this. You know, I was like, oh, this is hard work. Managed to get this like a last minute flight back to the UK. They're like, there's a flight going. And we were stinking, you know, a fucking beautiful moustache. You know, and we jumped on this flight, so I hadn't like washed any of my clothes, and we ended up back in the UK, and then we managed to get on a train, just me and some lads from the northeast, heading back on this train. We got some tinnies, and it, like, mega rough, stinking
drink, still.
Yeah, it just comes straight out of the fob, and we hadn't had time to turn around, like no haircuts, not, you know. And then, and I remember my little bro came to meet me at the train station. As we passed through a station, I was like, mate, come home with me. I literally just got on the train and came back with me. But yeah, I'd gone out for a meal at the end of...
A few days later, is it?
Yeah, well, kind of at the end of my R&R, really. And I was walking back to the car. It's sort of late on at night, and there was six lads, and they started chatting to me, and it seemed all right. And I was like, you're all right, lads. And honestly, like, my guard was down. I was like, I'm back home. I was born in the city of York. I'm back home. I'm safe. And these lads jumped me.
Did they know you were a Royal Marine?
Nah, I don't think so. Nah, they didn't know anything. No. I was just a bloke, and they were out to fill blokes in, and I just happened to be walking down the wrong place. They're chatting to me. The next thing, I opened my eyes. I'm mega comfortable. I thought I was in bed, and my missus is holding my head, and she's like, someone hit you. And what happened is someone had hit me from the side, just banged me, snapped my jaw, knocked me out. And then I was probably knocked out for, I don't know, good few, 30 seconds maybe. And as soon as she said someone hit you, I jumped up and I went running down the street to go get these lads. Just that instinctive, like, who did it? Where are you? Come back here. Anyway, I ran around the corner into these coppers, and I went to start saying, oh, someone's hit me. And as soon as I went to speak, my face just was I couldn't talk. And my whole face swelled up. And they got an ambulance, went up to hospital. My jaw was snapped, just snapped. And I couldn't speak, couldn't eat, couldn't drink, couldn't. I remember one time I was trying to have some painkillers, like pushing like paracetamol in between my teeth, trying to push them in. And then I started like choking on this thing, and I couldn't cough, I couldn't open my mouth. Oh, it was agony. It was such a, it was such a pain. And it's, man, this situation, like nothing is neither good nor bad, right? So this it is what it is. I had my jaw broken. I missed the last month of tour. I managed to get out to Cyprus for the decompression with the lads. And it was at this point when, you know, there's a few lads who just wouldn't speak to me. And it was only months later, it's quite hard work, you know, I found it difficult. And it was a few months later that I was having a report with the boss, and the boss said, oh yeah, I know you've had a bit of a hard time recently because some of the lads think you broke your jaw on purpose. And I was like, Jen.
To miss the last bit of the tour.
The lads, yeah. And this is the thing, it's not even my first tour, like I'm happy.
And
to,
you've done 5-6 months anyway.
Yeah, and it's like, I couldn't believe it. And it's like the lad who had hit me got arrested. He was arrested and he pleaded guilty to GBH at Magistrates Court, Peter Camage. And he got arrested and he pleaded guilty at Magistrates Court and was sentenced to 6 months in prison. So the lad's been, I had a letter from the court. Yeah, he's pleaded guilty. I've got my x-ray with my name and the date and my broken jaw. Mm. And I was like, how can the lads think? I didn't even know that the lads thought I'd broke my jaw on purpose to get out of 1 month.
Was you a popular member of the...
Well, yeah, I thought I was all right. Like, you never know, do you? I thought I was all right, but there was one lad that I did, as a young Marine, I guess I kind of got bullied a bit, and it was, So I don't really want to talk about this. It's embarrassing.
It's,
yeah,
it's other people's ego that can dictate how they behave towards other people as well. And
yeah.
I'll frame it. You were going to get written up for what you did on that day where you put your body in between the Taliban and the lad who you dragged out. You Kazivak'd. And then someone else was written up for the thing that you did.
Yeah.
You don't have to say names here. And I probably suggest we don't.
Yeah.
But you got a lot of shit off the back of that, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, because lads thought that I'd like chickened out. You know, and it's...
Well, was it lads or was it one person people?
Yeah, it was one, because I met another lad who had gone out as a BCR and he was a rejoin. So he'd been in the Marines, he'd left the Marines to do some maritime and then he'd come back to the Marines. And he had gone out then and taken my bed space. And he was like, mega sound with me. He rocked up. He's like, yeah, how's it going? I took your bed space. And he said, oh yeah. He said, oh, that bloke's a shit bloke. But I take everyone with a clean slate and you seem all right to me. Mm. And I was so grateful that this bloke was just take, because you had young lads who joined the troop who didn't really know, and they'd speak to this guy and he would say, he's, you know, don't talk to him. And it just made it very difficult for me.
And he was awarded what, this lad?
He's awarded the CQC, Conspicuous Gallantry Cross.
And you were getting...
For multiple events, you know, it was... Yeah. He had done stuff, but he... I don't know. Yeah, it's... It annoys me that he made my time, my early years in the Marines, he made it very difficult for me. And I don't know why he did that.
Like, did you then feel like you were trying to prove yourself?
Yeah, I did. So then I went medal chasing and I was like, send me anywhere. I want to go anywhere. You know, I want to do everything. I wanted that military cross because it was, I felt like if I could be awarded that, that would prove that I'm a good guy, that I'm not a shit bloke.
You're not dodging.
Yeah. So I sort of applied for, well, I was saying, you know, put me in for everything.
You went to, did Norway and all the rest of it. And was it Mali?
Mali.
Mali. And then can you talk a little bit about your dad?
So yeah, I'd come back from Norway. This is in 2013. So after that tour in 2013, I sort of identified, at the time I had a preference in to go PTI, physical training instructor. And I'd also looked at like the medical side of things because I'd enjoyed doing the med practice, and out on tour, I'd gotten involved with a few casualties. And I thought, here's something that I'm good at that offers value to the lads, and it sort of gives me purpose. So I'd gone on to do like a Royal Marines medic. I became a Royal Marines medic. And then I'd been drafted because I'd done a couple of Norways. I went out to do like an advanced Arctic warfare instructors course or something like that, where you do tactical advisor and ski instructor. And I'd come back from Norway. This was 2013, come back from Norway. And I had a phone call from my mum, and she's like, "Hey, how's it going? Your dad's poorly. Your dad's not very well." Something. And like, as soon as she was saying those, it was almost like I knew what she was going to say. As soon as she started saying that, I was like, ah. And I just packed a day sack, drove back home, and sort of saw, I was like, okay, what's the crack? And my dad's like, yeah, I've got cancer. Or maybe my mum told me on the phone. I think I was like, just tell me, like, what is it? Like, I knew it was cancer. My dad was a champion smoker.
Mm.
So it's like, but yeah, I was due to deploy to Mali, Africa. And before I went, I'd come back to camp. Before I went, I touched base with the sergeant major, and he saw that there was something in, he saw there was something up, and he's like, what's the matter? And I said, oh, my dad's not very well. And I kind of wobbled a little bit. Do you know, my sergeant major had lost his dad, you know, a few years. And I think he could see what was going on. And he said, before you leave this camp, touch base with welfare. And the welfare office is obviously this guy on camp who's there to look after the lads, but no one goes down to see him really because there's a stigma attached. Essentially, if you're going to see him, you can't cope with something. So it's got this stigma attached. So I've never been down to welfare. So I was like, yeah, I'll touch base with him. And I went down to this guy's office, and I walked in his office and kind of tried to like literally just start off with, I'm okay. The crack is my dad's not well, you know? And as I went in his office, I just broke down. And he said, what we're going to do is we're going to hold you back from this next deployment. And sort of, you can go home on compassionate leave. We're going to send this other lad. I was a little bit kind of gutted because I wanted to do stuff. But I was also very grateful to, that's what I needed. I needed to go home and be with my family.
Was you with him?
My dad. It was again something that I found was like super difficult talking about up until the start of this year when a guy kind of said, look, you need to deal with this stuff because it's too heavy to carry it. It's been 9 years, I think. It's too heavy to be carrying this all the time. And it's acceptance essentially, isn't it? But yeah, me and my brothers and my mum, we helped my dad as he died. And it was, I found it like the hardest thing that I've been through. And that changed my perception on life.
Did you say goodbye to him?
Yeah, yeah. I never told him I loved him. And I told him I loved him then.
That same year, you got into trouble with the police.
Yeah.
How did that come about?
That was just the end of the year. I was out in town and I was going home. I was making my way home and I walked around the corner of a building and I saw one lad getting, you know, in a scrap with several other lads. Essentially, he was going to the ground and he was going to get filled in. And I'd just come round the corner as it was kicking off. And I just made that split second decision again without the luxury of time. That guy needs help. And I ran over, I hit the first guy, got involved with the other lads and sort of, again, just neutralised that enemy threat, as it were. And the police came and I explained what happened and they said, yeah, go back to camp. And the next morning, the sergeant major said, yeah, the police want to take a statement. So I went down to the police station and they're like, oh, just come this way, Mr. Stott. Took me in a room and said, right, we're arresting you for GBH.
And what had you done?
So the guy that I hit, I broke his jaw. And it was, you know, everything was on CCTV and I gave a statement, says, yeah, I did, I hit that guy. But you could see it on the CCTV. These guys were. It turned out later on that these guys had been specifically asked to leave town by a copper because they'd been acting aggressively, trying to goad other males into a fight. So these young local lads were calling blokes out. They've called one bloke out who's actually then started fighting back. So they've started having a scrap, and these lads have then got involved, you know, so you've got one guy on four, basically. And it's just, I mean, it's literally seconds after this that I've walked around the corner being confronted with a situation where you've got one bloke who's going to get beat up by four lads. No, there's no bouncers and no police. It's like, well, it's got to be me. You know, I've got to step up to the mark and help him.
Hindsight a little bit before we move on, but do you still feel that was the right decision?
Yeah, you never know.
He was getting filled in, wasn't he? He was getting battered.
Yeah. I mean, I'd definitely probably put a little bit more thought into it if I saw that situation again. And part of me would maybe leave it. You know, it's none of my business. And it's, you know, what if I then get banged out again? Or what if I then get charged for GBH and I get sent down or something? You know, it's not, I'm a lot more cautious now, a lot more aware and just...
Had you been drinking?
I'd been drinking that night, yeah, yeah. But not mega, like...
Yeah, you weren't, like, hammered.
Nah.
The months that went on, because this went on for quite a long time, like the best
time. I was on bail for 10 months.
Was it a stress?
Yeah, so this, it pissed me off because I didn't tell my mum that I was in trouble. I was on bail for GBH. But I was really upset with myself, and I thought I'm going to lose my career. And it cost me 12 grand in court fees, and I had to sell my car. And because I sold my car, I couldn't go home to see my mum. And we'd lost my dad. And it's like, I wanted to be there to, I'd said to my dad that I'll look after the family. And then I had to sell my car. And it was, I wanted just to say to the CPS, like, you don't understand what you're doing. Like you're really sort of hell bent on trying to get this conviction. But like, I don't know. Yeah, it annoyed me. The thing, like, with hindsight, looking back at the situation, it's like all the situations develop us to who we are. So I wouldn't be the bloke that I am if I hadn't been through these situations. So I don't know whether that's...
Well, you know, the question I was asked is, was it stressful? You know, were you stressed? Was it compounding? Don't reflect on it, but look about at the time, because your dad had died. It was
stressful.
And you...
And because of it, I was on a curfew from town, so I wasn't allowed out in town after 9 o'clock. I was pissed off with myself, and I really sunk myself into Alan Watts surfing and yoga. I'd go surfing before work, and I really, losing my dad had changed my perspective on life. And then this compounded, and it really kind of pushed me into a different path, which essentially is why I'm where I am in life now, because of this. I'd started moving down this path and looking at different ideas, spending a lot of time in the water and doing yoga. So essentially it developed me, I guess.
And during that 10 months, were you looking, and that's when that all started developing?
During that 10 months, I didn't drink and I started doing yoga. Yeah, and started surfing.
Really? Yeah. That would have been the easy way to go, is to just hit...
Get angry about it. Yeah.
Getting pissed off and getting angry.
Yeah, that wouldn't have helped.
And this went to court as well.
Yeah, it went to Crown Court, 4-day trial. And at the trial, the judge said, at the end of it, he said, look, I never speak on behalf of a defendant, but on this case, I feel I must. And I hope this has no implication on your military career. You know, he said, this shouldn't have come this far. This was defense of another. You made a split second decision to go and save that bloke, essentially. Yeah.
Did it affect your career?
Well, I was on a freeze draft for a year.
Were you still soldiering, like, during that time? Were you still doing stuff? Or did you get put into a job?
Nah, like, I kind of got put to one side, really, because I couldn't go away for any amount of time, because I had to keep touching base with the solicitor. And you know, I had to keep, every time my bail ran out, I had to go get arrested again. So I'd get put back.
Is that how it works?
Yeah, yeah. So I'd get put back in cells. I'd get locked up. And then if they granted me bail again, I could come out. So it's, if they decided they wanted to keep me in until the trial, then they could have done. But they, you know, so every, I don't know how, I don't know the periods of time, but when, oh, that's my bail run out, I'd have to go turn up at the police station and get put in the cell and just wait.
Do they like read you your rights and stuff? Is that what it's called? Do they formally arrest you? And then
I think, not every time, I don't think. I mean, they did it the first time, but I can't remember. Yeah. As a, can I have a magazine to read? I just read through National Geographic and I kept asking for Scran. Because I thought, there's nothing I can do, so I'm just, you know, I'm going to read and eat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was it then that when you went on side to go on your medics courses after?
I was due to go on my, so when I'd gone medic, I went on the course in 2010. I felt I'd gone down the wrong career path.
Oh, okay.
And there was a few times when I said, look, I want a branch transfer to go over to PTI. And anyway, I continued with the medics, and I was due to go on my Special Forces medic course in May 2013. But obviously my dad was ill and I was on compassionate leave. So I missed that course and I went on November's.
Mm.
So I did that course, but then I spent essentially 2014 on a freeze draft. So when that, because I was on bail. So after the court case, I was then able to get drafted and I got drafted to Poole.
Mm. And so you went as a Royal Marine?
Yeah.
To the SBS?
Yeah, so I was Royal Marines Commando, Special Forces Medic.
Yeah.
Attached to the SBS as a squadron medic.
Is that a different course?
Yeah, so then I did a selection course. It's called Black Serpent, and you sort of you do a bit of phys and you do a bit of advanced trauma. It's quite a cool course. I enjoyed it. And then after that, I then did like another course at Hereford. Again, same, you know, more advanced trauma care really. And essentially with it, it's prolonged field care, because potentially you're going to be in a more remote location. So your casualty chain is going to be slower. So you're going to be holding a casualty for longer. So then things like infection are a risk. Oh, okay. So instead of just patching up a point of wounding and getting them on a Chinook, you're patching up a point of wounding, but then you need to stabilize them and you need to make sure, you know, infection prevention and kind of keep them until you can get them out of there.
Did you enjoy that?
Yeah, I found it interesting.
Was it good to be with those different groups, these smaller groups?
I found Poole very, I found it stressful, because it's every bloke there is you know, the best. It's like such a high level. I didn't want to be the shit bloke, and it's I didn't want to drop the ball. It's very fast moving, fluid organisation. I'm very grateful that I had a stint of time there working alongside those guys. I think they're hoofing.
Did you know lads from when you were?
Yeah, there were lads that I knew who had gone through that selection with them operators. You know, lads that I'd been within the Corps. Because, I mean, I don't know what the percentages are. I think maybe 80% of the SBS is made up for the Marines. I'm not sure, something like that.
It's really high. And I think the next one is the Royal Engineers then.
Really? Yeah, yeah.
It's come a lot more. I think Dean Stott was one of the...
Yeah, yeah.
One of the first to kind of go in that way. Do you merge in with that group, or are you like the outsider?
Depends who you're working with. So I was in a squadron, and there's only two roles that you can be a Royal Marine Commando working in the Sabre squadron, and that's the medic and the signaller, and you're both SF Med, SF 6. So it's kind of, I thought that's kind of cool. Obviously there is a bit of a dynamic there where you are not an operator. So there is that, you know.
But respected and for the job role.
I think, yeah, it depends, you know, some lads, especially some lads who've needed a medic, you know, they've been deployed and the medics had to patch up some lads and they're like, oh, this guy is valuable. Like, we need him.
Mm.
So
when did Magic get involved?
Magic started, so when I was a little kid, I liked magic. I was born July the 30th. I was one of the smallest in the year. And I was just this little skinny, insecure kid. I liked magic, but I didn't want to do magic because I didn't want to be more weird than I already was. So I kind of left it alone, really. It wasn't until, as a young Marine, maybe 2010, young Marine, and I saw another Marine doing sleight of hand card magic. And I'd never seen that skill set before. I'd seen people doing tricks with a trick deck of cards, but I'd never seen someone just literally changing cards. And I thought, man, I want to learn that. And I wasn't the skinny, insecure kid anymore. So I was like, I don't mind doing magic. But I never, I got into it, and then I'd come out of it again. Then I'd get into it. I would, you know, I'd have a pack of cards on the windowsill, and every now and then I'd pick them up and start shuffling them, cutting them, just working on. And then it got to a point where I'd say to the guys, hey, check this out. I'd start doing tricks for the lads. And this was kind of woven through my career. And as the years went on, I guess I naturally progressed with the magic. So by the time I was at Poole, I'd done a few military gigs where, you know, charity dinner in the officers' mess, Christmas parties. Hey, can you know, that magic you do, can you come and do some around the tables? I remember working at an officers' mess, you know, as a Lance Jack in my Lovitz, going round the tables, doing this magic for the officers. And I was like, yeah, this is pretty cool. So it always kind of been there. But I mean, especially at Poole, the things that I loved, surfing and magic, were put on the back burner because it's such a busy place, so busy. And that's what I craved. I craved that freedom and flexibility. So when I left the military, I kitted out my surf shack van, and I was like, I'm going to do surfing, I'm going to do magic. And I was able to say yes to everything. So anyone who asked me to do magic, I got involved with Bremont. And I just started doing, you know, the same circles that you've moved in, with Woody, with you know, Foxy and Srudart, Bremont, like the bike shed. Just these are awesome circles. And I've kind of, you know, moved from doing a bit of magic, and it's been awesome. It has been.
What level are you at? Because...
level of magic?
Yeah, I mean, you're... The last time I saw you was at a Bremont event in Greenwich.
Yeah.
And it was fucking good. I was really, I was staring at the cards thinking, yeah, what the hell is going on here?
Nice. That's good.
And where are you at? Well, are you where you want to be? Is it your career?
Yeah, it has been. And it's been sort of full time for the last, say, 5 years. And I'm now at the point where this is my last year performing. I need a different primary focus. So I've hit a lot of struggles recently. The magic's been awesome, and it's taken me to different places. I've performed to some, you know, I've performed to like so many people, like amazing people, like Harrison Ford, like fucking, it's crazy.
He's on Britain's Got Talent.
Yes, and I did Britain's Got Talent. So I've done all my close up stuff. I've done mega nice events, you know, and I've done lads events down at S-Bomb with Invictus Motorbike Club, their Christmas party. I've done like rougher events and very, you know, very beautiful events. I've performed to some awesome people, and I've taken it on TV. I've taken it to Italy on TV. Me and my bro performed out there on national TV. Done Britain's Got Talent, big danger stage magic. So I'm ready just to kind of put it to one side for the moment, and literally just take on another primary focus. I need to get my teeth into something else. The struggles that I've sort of dealt with really are because I've had this drifter lifestyle, you know, in and out the van, on the road, and I haven't had those pillars of stability, like a normal job, which gives you the structure. And that's, you know, that's what I've found tricky. I'm drifting too much, and
so,
I need to...
So the magic gives you... I don't know if it's not stability. The magic's giving you this purpose and this, you know, perfecting and performing.
Yeah.
And you've taken it to, but you don't want to be a drifter anymore?
I want a family. I want to settle down. Essentially what I came to the conclusion that I need to just build a home and train on a regular basis, have a normal job for a little bit. I want to literally do a normal job. I want to work in a coffee shop, so that I'm out of the house, I'm out of my head on a regular basis. Every morning I'm going to a place of work that's social and simple, so I can almost access this state of boredom, which will allow me to be more creative, because I've got some things in the pipeline, in the well-being world, that I want to move into the wellness space. And I'm formulating these ideas, and I need to just have something to be going through. So I've got this just consistent structure, day-to-day life and have consistency with my training and with my meals and all that, instead of like eating on the road, living on the road, in and out of the van. And I want to have a family. So I just need to settle in a place first and do that. I think I'll come back to magic, but also I put a lot of self-inflicted pressure. So I'll be putting on my suit and almost hitting some mental block where I feel like I can't do this. I can't do this because I'm putting all this pressure on myself. If I'm performing at someone's wedding and they've booked me for their special day, if I mess it up, I feel like I'm going to ruin their day. It's got to be awesome. And it's, I put a lot of pressure on myself with it.
I before we'd ever met, I'd seen you on social media. I must have seen you on social media. And that's got its own, what's the word? Kind of viewpoint. You're actually, the things I've seen recently, you're very open about good and bad on social media. But I would see you as this big, strong man. But before we went to record, you've said you feel like a scared boy quite a lot.
Yeah, well, I said that scared little boy is still in me at my core.
Yeah.
No matter what the exterior looks like. I mean, I'm definitely a lot more comfortable than I used to be. Yeah. But there's still that, there's still some niggles there, I guess.
Is it fear or is it confidence? What, or is it something else?
I don't know.
You stopped drinking in 2020.
Yeah.
Why did you stop drinking?
So that was on New Year. Every time New Year comes around, I have a little think back to the Afghan incident. I think about it a lot anyway, but obviously I think about it then. And I'd been drinking and it sort of sent me off on a little bit of a spiral. And I ended up, after that, I'd spoke to a guy, Sam Sheriff, who set Reorg up. And he spoke to me on the phone and he'd messaged me saying, "You're all right." I was like, yeah, I'm all right. And then he rang me and he's like, "Don't say you're all right if you're not all right." And he sort of debriefed me a little bit and he said, had you been drinking at the time when you had this little bit? And I said, yeah. And he sort of said, "Drink does nothing for you." And I felt so embarrassed and I really respect him. And I said, okay, cool. And right there, I just made this decision. I don't drink anymore. And it wasn't like, I'm going to stop drinking. It was literally, I don't drink anymore. And it was part of my identity.
Mm.
And I think it sort of made it easy. Like I've got no interest. And the longer it's gone on, so it's been like a year and a half now, I'm almost a bit negative towards drinking. I'm not interested in it at all. I don't think I'll go back to drinking.
Is identity important? You know, you didn't quite feel right in the Territorial Army. You then felt like a Royal Marine. Do you feel like a magician, a performer, and do you feel like that your identity now is where you want it to be?
No, I'd say it's not. You know, I'm not where I want to be because I don't want to be drifting. I think identity is important, definitely. I definitely identified as a Marine. And I loved it. And I think that's one thing when you leave, you're sort of losing an identity. I never really got fully behind the magic. It was almost like I enjoyed doing it. And it was almost like a bit of a channel, a bit of escapism through magic that I hadn't noticed. When I left in 2016, I worked at an outdoor center place in the French Pyrenees and groups would come out and do climbing and kayaking and hiking. And we were up one night. And these guys were asking me about Iraq and Afghan. And one guy made an observation that I'd never been aware of. And he said, every time you're talking about deployments, you're cutting and shuffling the cards. And I noticed that I would, I'd almost access like a flow state with the magic and I'd lose myself into it. And I think I used it as an escapism through my career as well. And it was, I didn't really want to be a magician. I left the Marines. And people asked me to do magic and I was able to say yes. And the more I did, the more it grew from there. So it was this unintentional career transition. I could have definitely got behind it a lot more and pushed it a lot more, but I didn't.
You know Mo Morris?
Yeah, yeah.
So I chatted with Mo recently and he was the one that really pushed me onto this, and I've used it several times since. And I think I've used it in this podcast, where about therapeutic activity, the difference between therapeutic activity and therapy is totally different. It sounds to me very much like the magic was a therapeutic activity.
Yeah.
Do you feel like you have been, do you feel damaged by war? Do you feel damaged by the loss of your dad? Or do you feel like this is part of you? And you said something earlier on, it's neither good nor bad.
Yeah.
What do you feel? Do you feel damaged, or do you feel this is just part of it?
No, I think it's part of it. I don't feel damaged. Like, I'm so blessed. Like, honestly, there's my mate sort of checks in. I have a few lads that check in. We kind of check in. Yeah. The lads look after the lads. And this guy messaged me saying, so it's Sam Laird, good BJJ guy, awesome bloke. And he had checked in with me and said, you know, how's life treating you? And as I was writing a message back to him, I was like, yeah, cool, bro. Life is treating me well. And it sort of dawned on me. It's like, life has always treated me well. You know, life is good. You know, I think, no, I definitely don't feel damaged.
Do you feel like you carry anything with you?
So there's, like I mentioned before we started recording, I noticed that I have got, let's just say pain, this pain at my core that I think is war pain. But essentially, I don't feel I've got snags. I don't feel I've got issues, but I have got pain. And losing my dad was a shame to see him go.
We're allowed pain, aren't we? Pain's good. It means something that was important has happened in many respects.
That's what you said to me out there, didn't you?
Yeah.
It's because it means something. Something means something. Yeah.
I'm in pain because my dad died. He died a few years after yours. I'm in pain because my mum died. But I'm also love it as well. Like, I love thinking and being, you know, I mean, you know, we've all lost and gained in many respects as well. You know, like a minute ago, you was talking about when you had that 9 month period where you were on bail and you go surfing, you do yoga. That's such nourishing things to do.
Yeah.
Such good habits to get involved with. Do you reflect on things now? Let's say if you're not in the greatest frame of mind, and do you implement these good habits? Do you practice, I suppose, what you preach?
Yeah, I really try hard to implement these good habits. Like, my little bro's been a big teacher to me, kind of introduced me to the works of Jordan Peterson and Sam Harris. Also Huberman, we both listen to the same sort of information. I mean, it's amazing to live in a world now where you can essentially choose your mentors. You can choose who you listen to on Spotify. You can choose where you get that, your input. So like, I try and practice daily, you know, implement daily things, daily habits that are beneficial. Yeah, I mentioned to you before, someone said to me that they're coping mechanisms. I'm not actually dealing with the cause of the struggle.
What do you mean? Sorry, go on. What do you mean? The cause of the struggle. What is the cause of the struggle?
So essentially, like, I was getting frustrated that I don't drink. I get up every morning, get the morning light in my eyes, go for a run, have a cold shower. I meditate. I do my breathing. I do jujitsu. I surf. I do yoga. I read. I listen to podcasts. I feel like I'm doing a lot of stuff. I eat well. And yet I was finding things hard and I got frustrated with that. And that's why I've been like really open on sort of social media about it. Like, I'm struggling, I'm hurting, you know, I'm trying to do these good things. And it was only this week when I was talking to someone and they said, yeah, but what you're doing is coping mechanisms.
Mm-hmm.
You're not identifying or like dealing with the cause of why you're feeling like that. So I think there is something to be dug into there.
And why, maybe I'm going around in circles here, sorry, just to understand, what was you feeling like to make you feel so frustrated?
I was getting lost in my head a lot with negative thoughts. and having to sort of almost like try and press that reset button as in jump in the water, because getting into cold water just feels awesome. You feel awesome after it. So I don't know why I was having such negative thoughts. I'm still a bit lost, really. Yeah. Like I said, this lifestyle that I've kind of lived for the last 5 years, drifting a little bit, it's not great. You know, I need to have some stability. And I think, again, so my dad had bought a camper van to go on holiday with my mum the year that he died. So he never went away. And he'd got to retirement, 60 years old, retired, was going to go down to Spain with my mum. And it never happened. And I thought, the thing is, from a shit situation, you've got to take something. Otherwise, it is just nothing but a shit situation. So you've got to try and extract a positive. And I thought, I need to learn from this. And like, I need to be living my life now, which is why I kitted my van out. And it's, I'm going to, you know, sort of embrace things more. But then the flip side of that is I've lived with, I've sort of drifted for a bit and I haven't had consistency and stability.
Like a jigsaw, isn't it? Like you've got all the bits. You need to start piecing them together. And actually we do. And it's a good example, mate. You're so open as well. And so you wear your heart on your sleeve and say it as it is and not hold it back. Like the ego's gone or the ego's not toxic.
Yeah.
And it's easy just to not to speak about this stuff. And we don't know all the answers. You don't know all the answers. I don't know all the answers. You try and sometimes you get frustrated. But the fact is you've got a toolkit there of really positive things. And you said it a minute ago. You said blokes look after the blokes.
Yeah.
That's not the case for a lot of people.
Right, yeah.
A lot of people don't have that. That in itself is unbelievable.
That's what I wanted to put out there because it was at the time of the Distinguished Gentleman's Ride and I was really struggling and I'm looking at these statistics, 125 lads a week are killing themselves. Like so many people are hurting and I'm like, we need to do something about it. The world has never been a more accepting place for blokes to talk and they're still not talking. Talking's not the answer, it's action. Blokes need things to do. So I wanted to put together those things. Like if me and you went for a run through the woods, we'd feel good from it. If we then combined that with a dip in the river and then had a coffee and then put some music on and had a little chat, we'd feel awesome. And you could do all that in half an hour. And I sort of want like almost this immediate action plan. When you are feeling shit and you're struggling to get out of bed, it's like, implement these things, do this. And you could do that on a regular basis, every Saturday morning, half an hour, just to help keep you good and then implement all the other things around your life. Like, don't be sitting up all night drinking, eating a pizza, you know, just having bad habits. You know, I see a lot of people say, oh, I'm struggling with this. I'm struggling with getting good sleep or something. It's like, but are you trying to get good sleep? You're falling asleep on the sofa watching the TV on your phone. You know, you're not trying to get good sleep. You're not doing turning screens off, turning lights off, having a bit of breathing, doing a breathing practice, having a stretch. You know,
it's sometimes as well, like action is one thing, but sometimes people have to hear someone. Someone needs to give them permission to do something. This is what I often find. Someone needs to give someone permission. So hearing you today, for example, talk about not settling for second best, like going for the number one thing, for example. Might be a young lad or a young girl listening to this going, you know what, I'm going to not settle for that and I'm going to push. So sometimes permission giving is really important. Education is really important. Like then following a role model. Oh, right, okay, they do it like this. They do it like that. And then the action then comes off the back of that. Like, is it inspiration? Is it, you know, like, inspiration without action, is that inspiration? I don't know. I'm not sure. What's next? We've talked about what you want, but what's next for you?
So me and my little bro, we're doing these motorbike adventures called the Motor Vikings, and essentially we're trying to find purpose through adventure. So we sort of identified that we're struggling a bit lost. So it's like, we need to have something, we need to have a purpose. And essentially, initially, like, it was just for ourselves. Let's take the things that we enjoy doing, like the motorbikes, the outdoor adventure lifestyle. My brother's a history academic, and I've got the magic. So let's ride from this place to this place, living on the bikes. And along the way, my brother's going to talk about the history of the route, and I'm going to perform magic to the people that we meet. And then we thought, if we're doing this, let's just film it and make these adventure documentaries. So at the moment, we're editing documentaries. We did a trip last September through the Alps, and it's a sort of east to west crossing, riding back in time, starting with the Italian Austro-Hungarian border, the Via Ferrata, the tunnels in the in the Italian Alps. We found a shell casing there. It was awesome, this awesome place. But talking about essentially these three prominent points in the Alps where soldiers have come over the mountains, and then me as a soldier going back to these locations, and my little brother telling me about this is what happened here. This is what was going on. We then went over to the St. Bernard's Pass where Napoleon brought his men over, and then we went right over to the west. So going back in time as well, to Hannibal, when Hannibal attacked Rome with his war elephants, and he took these war elephants up this gully. Man, it was mental. So we had that Alps trip in September. We've just come back from Greece, where we were looking at ancient Greece. We spent 2 weeks living on the bikes. We could have done so much more. There's so much out there. And go into these, it's mad, because you go into a geographical location where mythical characters went to. So I was telling you about, we went to the Necromantium, the Temple of the Dead, where Odysseus went to. Now, Odysseus is a mythical character from the Odyssey in some of the earliest literature in the world, but he went to this location. It's amazing. It's crazy. And then it sort of dawned us that we were going to these places where people before us had gone to find direction, and we were sort of going back, and it's, you know, asking the spirits of the underworld. But the same way that, you know, I said to you before, my dad said to me, like, you, even though I'm gone, you can still ask me, because you can still, even if someone isn't here anymore, you can still pose a question to them, and you know how they would respond, you know what they would say. So they're kind of part of you. So it's editing these documentaries. For me, I want to move to the Southwest, and I want to move into the wellness space. So there's a couple of things that I want to kind of get going. One, putting this toolkit out there. So for people that are struggling, it's like, come on. And I want to instigate that, you know, and push it out there. Struggling, like, let's go, let's do these things. And let's, you know, so the go for a run, dip in a river, have a coffee with a mate, but almost I'll do it online as well. So on a Saturday morning, I'll have a virtual coffee and kind of create a group and try and get this going. But I want to create as well, like, a check-in service. I don't know how it was for when you left the military. When I left, I've never heard from them. And essentially, I gave my life to the military. I want to create a check-in. How many service leavers have we got each month? I'll start with the Marines first. But literally, me just ringing the lads up if they want it. First of all, thank you for your service. Secondly, how's your sleep? Are you keeping on top of fizz? How's your relationships? What's your drinking like? How are you getting on? Have you found work? And on the first year of coming out of the military, sort of check in quarterly, and then maybe years two and three, every 6 months, and sort of create like almost like this check-in service. I feel like there's a gap where you've got a lot of military charities here, and you've got lads leaving here, people leaving the military here. Now, I was never at a place where I wanted to pick the phone up to Rock to Recovery and say, I need some help. You know, they have helped me in the past, but I never wanted to pick that phone up. But I'm struggling. But it's not this bad, but still I need something. So I want to fill that gap. If that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it makes perfect sense. Yeah. I think it's good. I think you are a good role model to people, mate, and people, you will impact people, and you will never even speak to them, and you'll never see them. Social media, these videos you're putting together, the you know, being around you in person. Mate, thank you so much, and we will leave it there.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.